Welcome back to the Supporting Actress Smackdown of 1954. In part one, we talked about the airline disaster movie, The High and the Mighty, as well as the corporate drama, Executive Suite, from Robert Wise. Those are both ensemble pictures that say a lot about the 1950s, but also feel dated. Now we're going to move on to something more immediate that we'd already begun talking about, On the Waterfront. For those who have not seen the picture, get right on that. It's a drama about union corruption in New Jersey and the dock workers there suffering. But its true claim to fame is, of course, Marlon Brando's Oscar-winning performance. The movie won 8 Oscars in total, including Best Actor and Best Supporting Actress for Ava Marie Saint in her movie debut. Here's a little clip, and then we'll move back into the conversation.
Philosophy of life. Do it to him before he does it to you. What do you want?
Your gun.
We got the fattest piers and the fattest harbor in the world. Everything moves in and out. We take our cut.
Joey. Who'd want to kill Joey?
Well, listen, you know who the pistols are. You're going to keep still until they cut you down one by one? Get a doctor!
Stay away from me!
Yourself in the river.
Yeah, and that makes an interesting contrast with On the Waterfront as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is so, I mean, and On the Waterfront, it's, you can read it, you know, multiple ways, of course, because it is acknowledging the sort of danger of labor unions, but at the same time it's saying that they're the salvation of the worker. I think it's a very interesting movie, but it's just in such a weird time space because Elia Kazan and, you know, the House on Un-American Activities and all those things that there was so much stuff in the 50s about people like sort of ratting out each other. and so it's really hard to watch in some ways because it feels very raw in a lot of ways. And in, not just in acting, I think, On the Waterfront.
Yeah.
It does feel after, you know, High and the Mighty, which is, like we said, this star-studded, very studio system-esque movie, and Executive Suite looking for its benevolent patriarch, and Broken Lands, which we haven't gotten to yet, but is very what we'll call typical 50s Western. Mm-hmm. On the Waterfront does feel completely different. It really does feel like it's ushering in something radically different in term, not just in terms of acting, which we've been talking about a lot, but just in terms of direction, in terms of cinematography. Boris Kaufman's cinematography feels very experimental and different in comparison to the more standard shot setups that we're getting.
Yeah. I will say that looking at these other three movies other than On the Waterfront, these are all High and the Mighty, you look at it feels like it could break out into the pilot of Lost at any moment. Broken Lance, like, that is the kind of Western story that would migrate to TV in a couple of years. And Executive Suite, certainly this idea of the benevolent patriarch, like, television sort of took over in the late 50s. And the movies then, to differentiate themselves from television, sort of moved away from that in some ways. Like, all of these are stories that TV was slowly but surely taking over as this was going on. So this is kind of the last gasp of some of these forms and some of these story forms. Certainly the High and the Mighty, the disaster film, obviously became a thing. But like Western, you know, the Western got a lot more dark and cynical in the years to come. And there weren't a lot of big, you know, here's the good guy who's coming to save the workers' jobs movies, as you've mentioned. And, like, a lot of that was because TV was there and was sort of filling those gaps.
Mm-hmm. Well, and a lot of that... Oh, sorry.
No, sorry, go ahead.
I said, well, a lot of that had to do with what was going on in Hollywood at the time, too. This was kind of the death knell of the studio system. The Paramount case had destroyed the monopolies that the studios had. You know, the star system was basically falling apart. Like, I think On the Waterfront winning as many Academy Awards as it did is almost the Academy, like, giving up and saying, yeah, there's something new coming, and we can't keep shoving it out of the way anymore. That's what it feels like to me, at least.
So what we're dealing with here is a pivotal year, not unlike what Mark's book is about, Pictures at a Revolution, with 1967, yeah. Only the movies are much better in 1967.
Well, the year that's going to be the death knell for an old system is not necessarily going to be the best year for that system.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and I think in some ways the story that Mark tells in 68 is the story that in some ways begins in 54. You know, it's like because one of the things that strikes me about On the Waterfront is of the three films, it's the one that also seems to be very personal. It seems like there's something at stake being in the making of this film. And I would attribute that to Kazan. Like, there's something like historic, he's trying, you know, there's something, and it's that idea of that American auteur, the idea of this filmmaker that's got a vision, that's got a statement to make, that's trying to do something separate from the properties, which all the three other films in this that we saw all feel like property. For me too, it's always a little bit of, I can't tell, like, okay, so the rat is the hero. Okay, Elia. You know, it's like, you know, this, there's a lot of things going on there that seem to be very much about whose voice are we hearing when we watch this film.
Well, and that's also what I'm talking about it being, you know, hard to watch in a way. Like, yeah. Not as cathartic as you would think something that rousing would be, because it does feel like any action anybody takes has dire consequences. Like, even like being heroic has consequences that are not pleasant.
Yep.
I think it's really one thing is it's really a New York movie, and not just in its setting, but in this whole aesthetic that I think Todd was talking about. You know, the connection of these movies to television. You could really imagine extending that to On the Waterfront, because this was this moment when things like Playhouse 90 and you know, all of these dramatic anthology shows were coming out of New York, and a really strong generation of directors was coming with them. And, like, black and white, psychological realism, gritty subject matter, a kind of stripped-down aesthetic, theater as a huge influence, it all really set On the Waterfront apart from these very... lacquered movies that we've been talking about, you know, that were in the same category. I mean, I think even in terms of the direction of actors, there's a huge difference between, like, the ensemble of The High and the Mighty, where it's like every star gets his own moment and in his own or her own setting, and the ensemble of On the Waterfront, which is like in those first scenes of On the Waterfront where you're in the bar or the pool hall or whatever, I felt like that to me felt like an ensemble that had done this on stage 200 times. I mean, they breathed each other's air. They lived, like, no one was kind of trying to seize a moment. It was just this completely, you know, everyone was working toward the same goal of realism. It was a completely different way of looking at ensemble acting than any of these other movies were.
Yeah, and you could imagine, like, I don't know how Kazan shot these things, but you could imagine that if he had a lot of coverage, he would have had multiple choices at any point for reaction shots, because everybody seems to be living within that moment, within that very specific space. We're now going to start wrapping up our conversation with Broken Lance. Broken Lance is a Western starring Spencer Tracy and Robert Wagner. And it's about an Irish cattle rancher who has a Native American wife, and a lot of people don't like that about him, or that his son is biracial, his son played by R.J. Wagner. And it's a little bit of a King Lear situation, only with sons, because all of his sons want his riches, and there will be much warring and family betrayals and the like. Here are a few clips, and then we'll jump back in to wrap up the conversation.
There ain't a man living who can say that he stole cattle from me, but you two mushheads thought. All right, you wanted him so bad, you take him. Take him and get out.
Bring him back.
No, send him away and that's that.
He's a bearcat, ain't he?
He's an old tyrant. But you're crazy about him, aren't you?
What? Yeah. Yeah, I guess I am.
And you're not afraid of him either.
The company didn't send me out here to be buffaloed by a loudmouthed farmer with a squaw for a wife and a half.
You're his little pet. You always were.
Now you know you want something, Horace. What is it? What do you want?
I want your son Joe to stay away from my daughter.
I don't like this.
I don't ask you to like it. I'm just asking you for once in your life to take some advice.
But I'm wondering, do any of you feel like Broken Lance had... I thought it came across as kind of ambitious. Like, it maybe wanted to be darker than it was. But it was also very glossy.
Yeah, it felt to me like the kind of movie that, like, nowadays would pop up at Sundance and people would be like, wow, I can't believe they made this for, you know, whatever, $500,000. Like, it felt to me like a movie that was... programmed almost as a B movie, and I didn't research too closely, so maybe I'm completely inaccurate about this, and then like tried to exceed the bounds of that. Like, certainly having Spencer Tracy there gives it the feeling of being like this big important thing, and the way the story is told, kind of that flashback that leaves you with some mysteries. But yeah, it felt like it was trying to do a lot. I'm glad I've seen this movie. I don't completely understand the nomination from it, but hey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I just thought of it in terms of, like, On the Waterfront, because it's also High and the Mighty and Executive Suite, and they don't seem to be... Like, the stakes are there in Executive Suite, but in a really weird way. but these movies seem to be about very, very uncomfortable things. Mm-hmm. But Broken Lance doesn't always feel uncomfortable. But I think it kind of wants to, and I was just more intrigued by it than I was expecting to be. And well, the reason I'm talking about it, like, toggling back and forth with On the Waterfront is thinking about this whole thing about the changes in acting styles, and, you know, like, that Mark's completely correct that Robert Wagner was totally old Hollywood, but he was young. And I'm thinking about, you know, obviously his stardom is tied in with Natalie Wood's, but Natalie Wood, even though she was very old Hollywood, which... I loved that in the Pictures of a Revolution, when you're talking about who was old Hollywood and who was new Hollywood. And yet she also got really involved with the sort of wanting to learn more about acting very shortly after this. So she's sort of one of those people who's also trying to work both styles, like Shelley Winters, as you
definitely
said, Brian.
But also, this is very shortly after this film, Natalie Wood would have that pivotal role opposite John Wayne in The Searchers, which is in some ways the moment when the Western really matures as the site of doing of the preferred genre for doing racial melodrama. You know, that this way of doing a different kind of seriousness about racial melodrama sort of ends up becoming the site, what the Western ends up really dealing with on television as well as in film. And I think that this is in some ways maybe sort of might be an Executive Suite situation of sort of old Western, new Western, because it seems to be going on. Like, there's some of the same questions that are really become so potent in The Searchers just 2 years later, and then continue to be in Western over the next 10 years to the point where Mel Brooks could parody that in 73 and with Blazing Saddles. So this idea of the Western, as opposed to what it does in Stagecoach or High Noon, which is about frontier society and making a new world, it's more about, like, how do we deal with these embedded contradictions in the world that we exist in now in a way that doesn't go to the hot button sort of third rail questions of black-white stuff, like using Latinos and Native Americans as ways of thinking about racial difference without actually having to go really all the way there.
Mm-hmm. I was really surprised after I saw this movie, and I don't know if you guys knew this, and maybe if one of you, maybe one of you can shed light on this, that Broken Lands is a remake of a non-Western.
Yeah.
It's a remake of House of Strangers, which had been made just 5 years earlier, and I think was more of a kind of noirish story. And then it was remade again 7 years later. But I haven't seen, I don't think I've seen House of Strangers, so I don't know if this, if there was a kind of equivalent of the social issue plotline element, an equivalent of the Native American plotline that Broken Lands puts in. Mm-hmm. I mean, do any of you know House of Strangers?
I know it vaguely. I don't think it has that racial element to it, though.
It's with Edward G. Robinson?
Edward G. Robinson and Susan Hayward, yeah.
Yeah.
Just looking at the plot summary, having not seen it, there does seem to be an element of Italian-American versus... Mm. Mainstream culture, which is in the same neighborhood.
Yeah, sort of the xenophobia and different. Now, one thing I want to talk about with Katie Jurado, since I think we're basically all sort of in the same ballpark with her performance. She was very consistent in terms of the SmackDown. But I'm really curious to... It was not intentional, by the way, to have both Manuel and Brian on the podcast with this very historic moment, because she was the first Latina nominated, Katie Jurado. But I noticed, Brian, in your book, Latin Numbers, which just came out, that you actually talk about that the late 40s through the early 60s is kind of like a hugely historic period in terms of recognition for Latin performers.
Yeah, especially U.S. Latino performers. The quick tagline is more performers we would recognize today as Latino were nominated for and won Academy Awards between 1947 and 1964 than any period before or since. And so it's this peculiar glut. I mean, and it's a mix of people. It's people like Jose Ferrer and Anthony Quinn, Susan Conner, Katie Jurado, Thomas Gomez to start, and then Rita Moreno. But it's just, and what I talk about in the book is just this idea that almost all of them are playing cross-racial, they're playing non-Latino as often as they're playing Latino. And there's this sort of way in which the Latino actors in this period were especially useful to sort of occupy these intermedial zones of what race are they actually. And that's why, like, you'll see every one of them played Asian American, characters of Asian descent, of African descent, of indigenous descent, as often as they played characters of European descent or of characters of descent from countries we would recognize as Hispanic or Latino today. So I think that there's something very peculiar, but also very interesting, especially with a figure like Katie Jurado, who in this period is one of the only ones who had an of the nominated actors, is the only one who might not be considered U.S. Latino because she was arrived with a sort of established pedigree from Mexican cinema, and so she was among the group of sort of notable figures from Mexican cinema who were brought into Hollywood, especially in the collaborative years when Mexico and Hollywood worked together, and so. So she started doing work in the U.S. and then as a result of High Noon, I think had a degree of cachet for a number of years and continued to work mostly in the U.S. but back and forth. So she's a really interesting figure. And to be honest, I requested this year. I mean, I don't know if anybody else on the panel requested to do 1954, but I did because of Broken Lands.
Yeah. Normally I throw out the years just so the readers and listeners know. I throw out the years to panelists and see which ones they're interested in. But sometimes it's chosen randomly.
I think I did. I think I may have picked this one because I hadn't seen any of them, and now I'm sorry that I did.
That's exactly what I did.
Well, I'm actually happy that I got to see Broken Lands. You know, it's a compact Western, I've got to say. I was very surprised by how quickly it went. And if anything, the mention of the film being a remake actually makes me curious to go see the first one, just to see how it might have handled its issue of racial difference and exclusion. because as much as this made me think of The Searchers, what was frustrating was that it was talked about but not enacted. And I kept expecting that. I kept expecting some big moment. I thought, okay, this, you know, there's going to be some sort of confrontation, and maybe this is just an old, you know, I don't know, is it Warner Brothers who did this movie? Just sort of like, you know, putting their films away so people just can't rediscover them. But, you know, but it just never materialized.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I think the strongest scene is there actually seem to be stakes involved in the way people, the way racial prejudice works, with the scene between E.G. Marshall and Spencer Tracy, where he doesn't want his daughter to date the half-breed, you know, the half-breed son, which I thought was such a powerful scene and well-written, as comparatively to the rest of the movie. But it's odd because it's talking about, you know, this thing about, you know, it has progressive ideas about, you know, racial diversity and doing away with prejudice, but at the same time you have R.J. Wagner playing,
Native American. That sort of makes sense. I mean, I think the film actually argues for the assimilability of indigenous and Mexican, like Indian. The film actually, and I think within a few years there begins to be a little bit, like there's a hardening, you know, in some ways, what, like the period in the, like it was an open question of whether or not Latinos in the 50s were a different race. Like it's this open question of, are they more like white people or are they more like black people? Like this, there's an in-betweenness that's still really very much part of what we can see. And I think you can see it the way that different actors, which is what I was interested in my book, is the way different actors move in different ways. And in some ways by the 60s, there begins to be a sort of a clarification of what Latino looks like, and this idea that there might be something that we would now call Hispanic or Latino. But I think that the film really is startling to me because it doesn't stick to this this hard line between groups. It does sort of offer RJ as sort of an exemplar of assimilation, even to the point where he marries the white girl at the end, and they're going to assumably make other babies. Right. And so this idea that that the great melting pot ideal is sort of in some ways promised by Broken Lance in a way that we don't often see the melting pot coming out of the Western. You know, this is part of its experiment, and where in some ways it doesn't surprise me that it's sort of an adaptation from an immigrant or an ethnic context sort of story, because this idea of the slow assimilation of emphatically ethnic folks, how does that work? And when you're looking at the stories in the West and, you know, stories in the Southwest, it becomes this question of, is this a story of assimilation or is this a story of racial difference?
I mean, it's interesting that this was made three times in 12 years.
Yeah.
You know, from 1949 to 1961, because that was a moment when I think in many ways the way Hollywood movies tackled assimilation and issues of acceptance or tolerance was not to say, like, they, whoever the they they're talking about is, they didn't say, like, they are worthy of respect, they are equal, they have their own dignity. They said, they're like us.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you know, don't be afraid, they're just like us. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think in 1949 that probably felt like a fairly fresh message. By 1961, it was probably already starting to feel like a kind of stale and backwards message. So,
yeah, or just not, it's sort of like we were talking about, like, that maybe the good corporate oligarch would be the one we had faith in. Like, sort of a sense of, like, right, this isn't going to work. We hoped it was going to be that way, but it doesn't seem to be happening. And I think, like, thanks for letting me tout my book, but when I talk about the arc of West Side Story, it sort of follows a similar kind of thing of not really beginning to be about racial difference, but by the time the movie comes along, that's what it's about. And so it's sort of these shift, and so what happens, and the crisis of folks not knowing what Puerto Ricans were they like Europeans coming from other shores, or were they like African Americans coming up from the South? This kind of question was a real uncertainty of how to deal with racial difference. And so this question of assimilation, I think, is really, if we think about the idea of that end, of them riding off in the carriage while the ethnic mother looks on with hope, is really a sort of a pay-on to the promise and power of American assimilation and a melting pot idea. And I don't know that in 5 or 6 years that people looked at that with sincerity. I think it was beginning to look at more with cynicism.
Yeah, because when you, Mark, when you mentioned 49, I assume you're talking about Gentleman's Agreement.
No, I was talking about House of Strangers, the first.
Oh, right. Okay.
The first version of this. Okay. But sure, yeah. I mean, Gentleman's Agreement is one of the fathers of that, you know.
Of that whole school of movies.
You wouldn't be so mean to a Jew if you knew he was a Christian.
That's right. Well, so let's lighten the mood a little. I have a question. Did anybody understand the title? Because, like, there's the lance at the funeral at the end, and he breaks it, but I was completely... What did I miss some dialogue about what the lance symbolized? Like, I was a little... Did anybody understand that?
By the time the lance showed up, I assumed it was kind of like putting the end of Chinatown in Chinatown. Like, they came up with a great title for it, and then they went, well, we don't have a reason to call it this. But
I kept hoping one of the sons was named Lance.
Let's go. I'll go with that, with Earl Holliman character. The Earl Holliman character, he could be Lance because he seemed pretty broken. But I assumed it was about patrimony. It was about the breaking of the bonds of patrimony, and it was sort of that you can't hold too high to these lines of sort of accession of power. It's got to break if it's going to have a future. Like, I just thought that was the really subtle metaphor. So subtle that it got lost along the way. But I just thought it, because when I watched these films, I thought, like, oh, are all of these movies about a patriarchal accession of power? And in some ways, when I thought that sort of that John Wayne's too old to fly a plane stuff was going on, it was going to really be about this generational transfer of power. But so that's my guess. I don't know. But well, I think Logan Lance is...
Yeah, I mean, thank God John Wayne was there to slap some sense into Robert Stack. It's funny how slapping people really wakes them up in movies. They really get right back on the right track, always.
Especially on an airplane.
Didn't somebody slap somebody in Broken Lands, too?
I do like Brian's beat on Broken Lands, I have to say. Is that... you know, it helps explain why that big portrait of Spencer Tracy in that really gothic moment did more than Katie was allowed to do, frankly.
Yeah.
It's just that's probably the single most memorable image I can take from that film, is just how much he dominated and didn't let anybody else in, really. But, yeah.
So we've covered all the movies, but I'm curious, because it was such a weird short list, before we wrap up, I'm curious if anybody wants to, any supporting actresses they wish had been included that they want to give a shout out to.
Thelma Ritter.
Yeah.
I mean, I think almost all of us mentioned, I saw Thelma Ritter mentioned a lot in reader comments, certainly, and I wholeheartedly agree.
It could have been a thing where your default nominations sort of work against you sometimes when you're actually worthy. Because people are like, again?
Can somebody tell me a little bit about Rear Window in this year? Like, give me context Oscar-wise in terms of Rear Window just didn't get a lot of attention.
It
is that right?
It didn't do well, no. I mean,
and
I
do
think
we know why?
I think it was a... I can't remember if it was a hit or not, but it wasn't... Well, it was nominated for 4 Oscars, but director, writing, cinematography, and sound. But clearly the actors branch wasn't with it.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think that this is the one where, like, I sometimes imagine that Thelma Ritter got an Oscar just in those fantasy moments, and I would probably, in my imagination, you know, even though she's the legendary loser, there's times when I like to correct that in my fevered imagination. And I think I would probably give, like, this is one where I could see this being the one that if somebody said, if you ask somebody, a regular, or like, what did Thelma Ritter win the Oscar for? They probably would say Rear Window, you know? And so there's a kind of funny way that her absence here is conspicuous.
Yeah. Mm. And I would say, for me, I would say Mercedes McCambridge and Johnny Guitar, just because
Oh, yeah.
But that was another one that was probably not beloved at the time. It took a while to find its fan base.
Well, and then Agnes Moorehead in Magnificent Obsession.
Yeah, that's going to be my choice. I mean, she's great in that, Agnes Moorehead.
It's just funny that it's all these like actors that Oscar did actually like, so you wonder why yeah. they didn't.
Well, the one that I had the occasion to see Carmen Jones on the big screen not too long ago, and I walked out of that film absolutely blown away by Olga James, who plays the ingenue Cindy Lou in that, and just in a really powerful example of just sort of screen acting while singing. And she's one of the only actors, she's one of two performers in the film who's actually syncing her performance to her own voice singing. Because Ateur and Per Bailey are the only two. She was a recent Juilliard grad when she got assigned. And she gives a really powerful screen performance while singing. And I was like, it's such a negligible character. We don't think of her because we think of Diane Carroll or we think of other people who are in there. But there's something about her that is just so really vivid that I mean, it would have been great to see her in this mix. It would have been impossible because, I mean, and for all kinds of reasons. But I think that there's something, it would have been great to revisit her performance in this conversation, in this context. And then in my fantasy world, I kept thinking of like, okay, who of all the women in Salt of the Earth, which was this year as well, if we could have some other women who are doing labor in the Southwest around Mexican issues, let's have somebody from Salt of the Earth show up and see what they do to the mix. Because that would have been... you know, because there's a lot of not actors in that. There's a lot of great faces. That just the whole story behind that film.
Anybody else?
I just was looking at this year, and Sabrina was actually an Academy favorite, and I think there are some fun supporting performances in that. Like, I don't know that I would like stand up firmly and insist that they should be nominated, but I remember that Nella Walker and Martha Heyer were pretty fun in that movie. Like, I certainly would rather see them there than, like, you know, Claire Trevor.
I feel bad that we're, you know, because Claire Trevor is such a good actor, but that's just, it's baffling.
I kept wishing that June Allison had gotten the nomination for Executive Suite, because this panel would have gone bonk. It would have been a really interesting conversation.
Well, yeah, that's a thing I think about, is that a lot of these movies, not On the Waterfront and Broken Land, so two of these movies, have other women in them where it would, you know, you really could have made an argument for some of those people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I assume that Barbara Stanwyck was just, they always thought of her as a lead actress, so they were like, I don't know.
That was my assumption, is that Barbara Stanwyck was, you know, name above the title, and you do not give a supporting nomination to Barbara Stanwyck.
Mm-hmm. Not for that performance.
I knew Mark wouldn't let that slip by.
Doesn't Inside Oscar make mention of that sometime in the 50s, where, you know, top billed actors were very resistant to the idea of being demoted to the race? I mean, that's one of the reasons why I found Eva Marie Saint's presence there so baffling in some sense, because mm-hmm. in my opinion she was clearly a lead.
Yeah.
And maybe they were tired of 2 years in a row of having an ingenue come in and take the prize. I mean, because what was it? Shirley Booth and then Audrey Hepburn in 1953. So this would have been the third one. That's where I thought she would have been placed, and I don't quite understand why they put her there, or why they campaigned for her there.
Well, I assume they were trying to steer clear of Grace Kelly versus Judy Garland.
Mm-hmm. I felt like it was defensible as a supporting actress nomination. I mean, I think it's you know, screen time is part of it, but centrality to the storyline is also a part, and I mean, to me, it is Brando's movie, you know, his story with everyone else in support. I didn't mind it there, but I tend to cut supporting performances a lot of slack. Like, I think they can get big and long and still be supporting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could go both ways. I was hearing myself make both cases for it, but I think I would ultimately have put it on the lead category, since she is really his antagonist as much as she's his support in a lot of ways. Like, she's the one that forces him to be. But I could go either way. And I think if it hadn't been her debut, it might have been a lead. You know, it's just that kind of that sort of weird. She's young too, right. And there is an introducing, isn't it? Doesn't she get an introducing credit?
It is interesting that that actors were once resistant to the idea of supporting someone else, and now everybody's like all gung ho as long as it gets them more gold. Like they don't worry about it at all. And actors are like big stars constantly doing cameos now. There's like less and less room for like the character actor.
Yeah, exactly. When Tilda Swinton takes that part in Trainwreck, what are you going to do?
Nominate her.
Please. I'm hoping.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for joining us. Thank you again to Mark Harris.
Thanks.
Anne-Marie Kelly.
Thank you.
Todd Vanderwerf.
Thanks so much.
Manuel Munoz.
Hey, thanks everyone.
And Brian Herrera.
Thank you.
AKA Stinky Lulu. Thanks for originating the Smackdowns. They're still fun to do.
They are.
All right. Thanks everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
And that brings us to the conclusion of yet another SmackDown. There's one more left in the season, and we'll be doing 1963. So rent Tom Jones, Lilies of the Field, and the VIPs, and you'll be all set for the final SmackDown of the year at the end of September. In the meantime, please pick up the new books from Brian Herrera, Latin Numbers, and Mark Harris. His latest is called Five Came Back. And you can read Todd Vanderwerf at Vox, Anne-Marie Kelly and myself at The Film Experience, and Manuel Munoz at manuel-munoz.com. You should read his book, What You See in the Dark, which is inspired by Hitchcock's Psycho. It's so good. And he has two short story collections as well. Beautiful writing. So thanks again to the panel. Hope you enjoyed the SmackDown and seeing On the Waterfront again. And congratulations to Ava Marie Saint, who won both the Oscar and the SmackDown. We'll let her and Marlon Brando have the last words.
I don't make any jokes. I'd like to take this seriously, and of course, last year this spot proved to be a kind of a turning point in my life. And so, with a lot of gratitude, Mr. Miller, may I have the envelope? In New York, the winner is Eva Marie Saint.
Baby right here. But I would love to thank Elia Kazan and Sam Spiegel, Marlon Brando, Carl Malden, Boris Kaufman, all the longshoremen. Thank you.
A thrill, I think, for all of us to present the award for the best actor, an Oscar winner back in Hollywood for the first time in 3 years, one of the screen's first ladies and past president of the Academy, Miss Bette Davis.
I think you know that I feel just great to be back working again. And now I know that you're as anxious as I am to find out what actor has won the Oscar for the best performance of this year. Have I a little spread to tempt you all with this? The winner is Marlon Brando on the Waterfront.
Thank you. It's much heavier than I imagined. Gosh, I had something to say, and I can't remember what I was going to say for the life of me. I don't think that ever in my life have so many people been so directly responsible for my being so very, very glad. It's a wonderful moment and a rare one, and I'm certainly indebted. Thank you.